I don't have a lot to say about this appeal that isn't in my brief, but we'll make a couple points. When we had this special plea argument and the circuit court issued the letter opinion, the circuit court denied attorney's fees. And we filed a formal motion after that to have suspension of the final order and then a motion for formal indemnification. And we, cited the articles, the bylaws, and the statute. And we had a hearing in front of the circuit court, and the circuit court judge essentially just said, based on what I've heard so far, I don't like your client, I don't like this situation, I hated ruling on the statute of limitations, and I'm not going to give you attorney's fees. And I'm paraphrasing that, but that was essentially what occurred. What we would say is that the entitlement to attorney's fees under the articles, the bylaws, and the Virginia Code is all of them say shall. There's no discretion as far as awarding those fees. Former directors are entitled to their fees.
But isn't it implicit that it's reasonable? I mean, let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose a director concedes liability in a fiduciary duty breach and says, yeah, I breached it because I wanted to breach it and I pocketed the money, but too bad, so sad, the statute's wrong, and he wins. Would he be entitled to his prevailing party fees, even though he's concededly drained the company of the assets?
I don't know about that situation, but if you look at the statute, there isn't any merits test.
That's exactly what I'm trying to tease out. If it's true that we don't have an implied qualifier of reasonableness, it takes into account general common sense things like the absurd example I just gave. And then if it literally meant you are winning on a non-merits defense like the statute of limitations, it would mean that a tortfeasor could acknowledge and actually concede liability for the fiduciary duty breach, win on a technical point like statute of limitations, and then still get 100% of his indemnity back. It just sounds quite odd.
That strikes me as unfair. That didn't happen here.
But your interpretation of the statute, I think, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, would logically say, yeah, but that's just too bad, so sad. That's the way it works.
I think if you are a director and you prevail, whether it's a statute of limitations, motions to dismiss, under Virginia law, the statute, the bylaws, and the articles of corporation, under just an interpretation of those two documents in the statute, Judge, I believe that director does get their fees. And what happens sometimes with former directors is they sometimes do things that aren't proper. And again, I'm sitting here in a situation where the allegations are admitted as true, almost like a demur that I'm dealing with. We deny these allegations. But
that's the hard
I'm
part about this, because if it weren't what you say, we'd have a trial on the merits anyway, just to determine attorney's fees, to find out really who the bad guy is. And that doesn't seem reasonable either.
You would have to, the former director has an entitlement to those fees. The reasonableness of those fees, now that's where I think if we would have had the opportunity to file our billing statements, a judge could say, now, I'm not going to give you much in the way of fees here because what I've seen so far, I don't think they're reasonable given the conduct that I've seen.
Okay, can I stop you there? So in theory, I'm not trying to get you to concede anything. Just let me think this through, though. In theory, though, if this were to go back to the trial court to review fees, the trial court could say, look, you defended this charge of whatever, fiduciary duty breach, and you were obviously guilty, and you just were pushing, stalling as long as you can. I'm not going to give you any fees on that. I'm not assuming that you're conceding anything. But could, in fact, a trial judge use the reasonableness qualification that far?
That's what I've seen it used in my career, Judge, is when the trial judge gets into the merits of the case when they determine the reasonableness of the amount, not the entitlement.
Okay,
so I think we get the entitlement, and then I think a circuit court judge could say, Mr. Lynch, I see all of your fees here. You could have won this case quicker. I don't like some of the, that's where I think the discretion comes.
All right, so you put a battalion of attorneys on this when a single attorney would have sufficed. Your hourly rate is $1,000 an hour, that's not the going rate. That's what you're talking about, right?
Okay. I'm talking about that, but also in talking about a time where a trial judge says, you spent a lot of time on a position that I didn't think had any merit.
There you go.
I mean, something like that, and I think that happens all the time. I do think in this situation, we defended the case on the special plea, which, you know, had merit, and we would ask for the fees on that.
So going back to my hypothetical, in that situation, a trial court could say, look, it was obvious from all the discovery that came in that you were caught red-handed doing this, and you fought this case for 14 months in my court. I'm not giving you any fees on that. And they could say, I'm entitled to fees. No, you're entitled to reasonable fees. It was not reasonable to fight this and to stonewall for so long. In theory, that would be within the scope of the trial court's discretion. Is that right?
I think once you get to the reasonableness, Judge, I agree with you, not the entitlement. I think the ruling has got to be you're entitled to fees under the statute and under, you know, the bylaws and the articles. But once you get to reasonableness, I think the court has, under a lot of law from this court, you have a discretionary standard on the reasonableness with a lot of factors the trial judge is allowed to look at. I can appeal that, but I'm fighting an abuse of discretion standard and the facts of a case. But I think it goes to the reasonableness of the fees, not the entitlement.
And your point is, if a suit is timely brought and the directors are caught in some kind of breach, that's where they forfeit any kind of reimbursement of costs and fees. But if it's not timely brought and you prevail, period, in the story, and you have no reason to get into all the merits because you just have a silver bullet statute of limitations argument. So you prevailed under statute, that's it. And so that's an extra incentive for the plaintiff to be timely, because then they expose themselves to fees.
That is my position, Judge.
All right.
Yeah. Unless there's any other questions that...
All right, Mr. McLaughlin.
Excuse me, may it please the court. One of the arguments, that we made on this appeal on this subject is Horton versus Horton, which is the case by this court that held that having to do with the party that first breaches a contract. The position of the appellate in this case is that they are entitled to their fees for defending us even if they acted in bad faith, and even if they have no equitable, that their position is not good at all in equity in that. And it seems obvious.
I don't think they're saying that. I think they're just saying we never got into the merits. I mean, maybe they have an argument for the underfunding. I mean, I just don't know. I mean, maybe the developer out of his own pocket was fixing things with a view to later sell. I mean, I just have no idea factually. And so we just have a statute of limitations. Any lawyer is going to say, I'm not going to spend all this money and time on the merits when I can get you out on statute of limitations.
Well, it's certainly true, as I think is the premise of Your Honor's statement, that they have not acknowledged, they haven't said, we acted in bad faith. In fact, they say to the contrary. But in their argument, they say that even if we acted in bad faith, we're entitled to these fees.
As a practical matter, Mr. McLaughlin, when would the trial court make that decision? The case goes off on a plea and bar on the statute of limitations. You're alleging bad faith. They're defending no bad faith. When would the trial court, would they have a mini trial after the plea is granted and try the case to determine who's right and who's wrong? When would the court make that determination?
Well, I think in this case, the trial court said pretty clearly that based on the facts that were before the court, the court indicated, it seemed clear to the court that Mr. Gaddams acted in a self-serving manner. And it is so in this case, and it's in the record, that the appellee's counsel, in oral argument before the court, said, we don't question the fact that we controlled this board during this period of time. And I think the trial court seemed to indicate that, and it didn't seem to be any question about the amounts that were put aside and that it was less than was required. And so the trial court seems to have found, based on what was before it, that there was not an indication of good faith.
Yeah, but how can
you admit that? And it may, in answer to your question, I think it's reasonable if, under these kinds of circumstances, if they persevered on that, to have had some sort of an evidentiary hearing.
So try the case that they've just won on the statute of limitations.
Well, because there remains the question of the attorney's fees.
But then there's a further paradox if you're going to go down that road. Typically, I mean, I'm most familiar with civil rights litigation because I did some of that work as a lawyer, and you get, you know, under Section 1983, you get attorney's fees, but you get fees for fees. So then the meter's running as you have your mini-trial on the subject of fees. So then instead of perhaps, like on statute of limitations, a fairly modest amount of fees, if you're going to have a trial within a trial, that balloons out to perhaps a colossal amount. Is that where we want to go with this? I mean, it seems like that's where that takes us.
Well, I think you make a good point. On the other hand, he is arguing that when it gets that if you rule in their favor on our appeal, which if you rule, I mean,
then that's a different kettle of fish because it goes back, and I think that wipes that out.
That would wipe it out. But if you rule in their favor and deny our appeal, and if it goes back, the question of good faith, he said, could be relevant to the amount of the attorney's fees. I thought I heard him say that.
But remember, there's two different things that it seems like to me that we're talking about here, because he was talking about not really good faith. He was talking about them doing work that didn't relate to, or additional work that didn't relate to, the defense that they actually had. I think that's what counsel was saying, that the court could certainly look at and deciding whether or not the amount of attorney's fees was reasonable.
Well,
I don't think that would be the
maybe
issue.
I misunderstood his argument. And I would just say on the subject that there was enough before the circuit court in this case that was not in dispute that I submit indicated that there was not good faith and that probably would not need a hearing on it. And certainly that's what the circuit court held.
But what was not in good faith? The defense on the statute of limitations, which, if he's successful on appeal, means he had every right in the world to make that defense.
Well, I'm not talking about the defense of the statute of limitations. I'm talking about the control of the board, which was admitted in argument, the failure to adequately fund the reserve.
Well, if they spent $100,000 trying to defend the undefendable, I would think a circuit court judge would take that into account.
Well, where you have a circumstance that they don't contest the fact that they underfunded, that the amounts that were funded, there was a report. The report said it wasn't enough. It wasn't covered. And under these circumstances, they kept control of the board. Under those circumstances, I submit that under Horton v. Horton, there is a estoppel argument. I submit to this court that circuit court on this attorney's fees issue really found in favor of estoppel. And what they say in their argument in their reply brief about this is not an equitable matter, it's a matter of law. But I submit an equitable defense can be rendered against a law claim. And if there is estoppel, if you go in with unclean hands, that's grounds to stop you from getting a recovery in law. Now,
do you have any authority for that?
I can't cite you a case on that, but I believe you can assert any reasonable defense. Well, Horton v. Horton.
Cause let me just tell you my understanding of what your opposing counsel basically said. It could be an instance where a director has purposely embezzled money, and then the association brings a lawsuit against them, and they say, yeah, I embezzled the money, but the statute of limitations has run. They assert their statute of limitations defense, and they win. They're entitled to their attorney's fees. And the only question is whether or not those attorney's fees are reasonable.
Well,
that's my understanding of their position. And you seem to be saying, no, the court should look at the fact that the person who asserted the defense of statute of limitations was an embezzler, and therefore they should be stopped from requesting attorney's fees. even though a statute says they're entitled to them. And that seems to be like an estoppel argument. You're saying that would prevent them from recovering. I'm just trying to tease that out.
We cited Horton v. Horton in support of that. You have correctly stated when I'm arguing like that. I confess that I'm hoping you're going to rule in their favor on the Southern people and that would moot it. But
can I interrupt one more time? Isn't there a middle ground between the two of you that Justice Goodwin is tapping on? What would be wrong with this scenario from your perspective, assuming arguendo you end up back in the circuit court? The circuit court judge says, look, you had a right to a statute of limitations. Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court says you were correct in law on that subject. So how much money did you spend on defending this case statute of limitations? I don't know, $75,000. Okay. Did he overbill that? No. Okay, you get your $75,000. What about the other $50,000, judge, that I spent defending on the merits? I don't know that that was defending the defendable. I'm not going to give you more than $5,000 on that. What would be wrong with that totally off the, you know, horseback opinion, which legal fees really are for circuit court judges, notwithstanding what we say otherwise, that's really what it is a gut call. What's wrong with that? Doesn't it make good sense?
Well, I, on behalf of my clients, do not want to concede the idea that if someone has done something that is wrong, that they are not entitled to a defense of estoppel based on the wrongdoing against collecting attorney's fees. And I submit that that is a reasonable outcome in a case, and I submit that if this court upholds the circuit court on our appeal, that the circuit court's grounds for denying attorney's fees have a strength of fairness behind it, and I would hope the court would uphold that in those circumstances. Unless there are other questions, I thank you.
All right. Mr. Lynch, you have some time available if you choose to use it. All right, thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 10 minutes until 11.
All right. Thank you.